Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And this is one of those days where everything went wrong, so I hope my luck improves as I do this show. I've got three segments scheduled for tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll talk with Max Frodwolf, the economist, journalist, and critical critic, as Marx once put it, all about the financial crisis and Tim Geithner's plan to save us all. Leveraged speculators will save us, it seems to be what it's all about. And then towards the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Nomi Prinz, who frequently appears on these little crisis roundtables with Max, but she wasn't available at this time, so I recorded something with her yesterday, and we'll get her evaluation of the Geithner plan and just what are these splendid talents that's worth so much money that make all these Wall Street hotshots so indispensable and so inappropriate to salary caps? And then, about 40 or 45 minutes past the hour, we'll hear from Steve Early, the labor journalist, about we spent three quarters of the show on capital, so let's spend the last quarter on labor and what's going on with the Service Employees Union, California Nurses Association, a whole bunch of strange peace deals and civil wars and an awful lot of bad stuff going on at a time when we most badly need a coherent and united labor movement. But before all that, in the economic news, looks like more signs of the stabilization I've been talking about for the last few weeks, especially in the housing market, following last week's pickup in housing starts, which is the term of art for when builders begin constructing new houses. Sales of existing houses, which are the lion's share of the housing market, rose by 5% in February, the strongest monthly gain in almost 6 years. The rate of decline in prices also slowed. But the way I just phrased that is a reminder that the market remains very depressed. Prices are still weak, and January's performance was revised downwards. I should point out that revisions to back numbers are frequent in almost all economic data, making January's performance the worst on record for housing prices. And despite the strength of the pickup in February sales in percentage terms, the pace of sales remains very close to all-time lows. But as they say, flat is the new up. Sales of new houses in February also showed a strong pickup following a string of steep declines. Despite that uptick, the sales pace remains quite low, and the overhang of unsold houses, both existing and new, remains at very high levels, and there are probably some foreclosed houses that are not even counted in those inventories. The price of new houses continues to fall. Still, this latest batch of housing data does suggest that the deep plunge has now slowed to a slow crawl, or may even to be turning around ever so slightly. Of course, it's way too soon to make all too much of this, but since housing is often the first sector to bottom out in a recession, this is mildly encouraging. As a reminder, though, not to get too carried away with jubilation, first-time claims for unemployment insurance filed by people who've just lost their jobs rose by 8,000 last week. Since this number bounces around a lot, it's sound practice to look at a running average of the last 4 weeks' data. That measure fell slightly last week after rising steadily for 2 months, so that too is a little encouraging, but it still remains quite high. And the count of people receiving benefits, which is a function not only of how quickly jobs are being lost, but also how quickly the unemployed find new work or run out their benefits, that continuing claims measure continues to rise. So as I've been saying for a while, the job market still stinks, but it's not getting radically stinkier from week to week. Isn't that comforting? Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, Mirek Topolánek, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, denounced the U.S. penchant for big spending stimulus and bailout packages as the road to hell. This is pretty funny, since his government just fell, mainly because the electorate isn't very happy with the way he's handled the economic crisis that's hit his country just like everyone else's. But when under attack at home, it always pays to go out on the offensive abroad. When I hear critiques like Topolonics, and you can even hear them from our own right wing as well, including some conservative Democrats, I always wonder what they'd like to do. Just let the economy go down the drain with no effort to counteract the implosion? But he does have a lot of allies across Europe, even if they're not given to such blunt turns of phrase. European governments and central banks have been quite slow to pump up the stimulus engine, leaving much of that work to the U.S. In their defense, it is true that their so-called automatic stabilizers, spending on income support and other social measures that rise automatically as unemployment rises, those are a lot more powerful in Europe than they are here. Just half of our unemployed, for example, are drawing unemployment insurance checks. And once those are gone, it's either the Visa card or the sidewalk. Not so in Europe, where the dole checks are almost always in the mail. Still, the reputation that the old world has among many on the American left isn't entirely earned. The European elite is very much into tight money and tight budgets and hates the sort of stimulus we're doing here. Given the EU's size, a somewhat larger share of the world economy than the US's, that slowness to stimulate could have unpleasant global effects. But we stimulators also have a problem. It looks very much like the Obama administration would like to withdraw the stimulus sooner rather than later. If so, what then? Turning back to the 1930s, we find that FDR, who was always uncomfortable with all the deficit spending that the Depression forced him into, was lured by the 1933-36 expansion into thinking that the slump was over, so he contrived a balanced budget for 1937. Unhappily, the economy, already weakening some in early 1937, took this turn back to fiscal orthodoxy very badly. The unemployment rate, which peaked at 25% when Roosevelt took office in 1933, had come down substantially to around 11% in mid-1937, but it shot back up to 20% a year later. This raises an important question or two. Will one round of stimulus this time be enough? And can we wean ourselves from it easily? Or are our problems much more deep-seated than all that? I've been coming around to the idea that in their heart of hearts, Obama and company are planning an eventual austerity program. That is, the only way to pay for all this stimulus if you don't want to tax the rich heavily, and it's looking like neither Obama nor the congressional Democrats want to do that, then there's only one way, only one other way to fund all these trillions of stimuli and bailouts: cutting social spending to the bone. More broadly, it would be economically rational, in the harsh orthodox sense, to prolong or even deepen the sharp contraction in consumption that the recession has brought with it. Less consumption means fewer imports, which means less money we need to borrow abroad. This is precisely the sort of structural adjustment strategy that the U.S., via the IMF, has imposed on scores of countries around the world over the last 25 years. Could it be that a candidate elected on high progressive hopes would turn into the agent of a homegrown structural adjustment program? He'd be the ideal agent for such a thing, in fact, because it would disarm the natural opposition to such a strategy. Were I given to cliches, I might say that this could be Obama's Nixon in China moment.
Think of what we've lost and gained since 49.
The current trend suggests that China's future
might break the futures market.
That would be a break. No doubt a plunge into the New York Stock Exchange will line some pockets here and there. Will these investments be secure? No, not precisely.
There's the catch. You don't want China to be rich.
You want to bring your boys back home.
What if we do?
You want to bring your boys back home.
What if we do? What if we do? Is that a crime?
Is that a crime? And that, an extract from, speaking of Nixon in China, Nixon in China by John Adams, an opera from the late 1980s at the original cast recording, the Orchestra of St. Louis, conducted by Ado DeVart. And that was a passage in which Mao, Zhou Enlai, and Nixon were discussing the possibility of China's investments in the futures markets, the New York Stock Exchange, and Nixon accusing Mao of not wanting China to be rich. Well, that was 30-some years ago, so things have changed radically since then. We're now joined in the studio by Max Fraud-Wolf, who is an economist, consultant, journalist, and all-around wise man. And
whatever also pays the New York rent, right?
Yes. And
also available for children's parties.
Yes. I hope you don't dress up as a clown, though. That would be
not unless the money's really good.
That would be unseemly. It scares my kid, too. Clowns scare them.
Being an economist, I'm already kind of half in the bag of the clown front, right? Yes. That'll make it any worse.
Yeah, well, so much to talk about. But I guess the immediate thing on everyone's mind these days is the Geithner plan. Tim Geithner unleashed his plan to save the financial system. And that's getting some good reviews from some people. Wall Street loved it. At least the stock market loved it. The credit markets weren't quite so sure. But first of all, give us a hint of what Geithner has up his sleeve. Just outline what his plan looks like.
Sure. Well, I love the alphabet soup. So we had TARP, we have TALF, we have TALF 2, and now we also have PIP. And I think that PPIP being the name of this one is appropriate on a lot of levels. And if I were on the marketing team in the Treasury for Mr. Geithner, I would have rejected that name. And I'll leave that to your vastly wise listening audience to figure out why that is. But the PPIP was somewhat popular on Wall Street because what it does, it looks back over the last few years and it says, you know what we didn't have enough of? Leverage. And you know what else we didn't have enough of? Government guarantees for privately placed bets in the credit markets. But I think we can get some more of those. And sometimes it is, in fact, the best way to go. It's to throw gas in the fire and let it burn itself out. If that's your predilection, then of course you'd like this. The other way you'd like this plan is if you have access to it. So the quick and dirty is there are two parts to this plan. One buys whole loans, presumably loans in trouble, probably for residential real estate, a bunch of auto loans, some credit card loans, and some commercial real estate. And if you go into the program with the government, you have to have $10 billion under management. So this pretty well excludes your family businesses, at least those without $10 billion in money under management for the last 5 years, which is a large number of smaller enterprises.
There's the Gates family, the Walton family, but
yeah, there's
that's
a few.
About it.
Yeah, it's not going to sort of – it isn't going to find a new – it's going to create a new lease on life for the subway that went under by your – corner place that you like to hang out. So it's going to be larger firms. They're going to put in money into an FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation run auction. That, let's say, put in $1 million. The government will match the winning bid with another million. And then the FDIC will underwrite their ability to borrow an additional $10 million. So leverage 6-to-1 and go out and buy assets. These are non-recourse loans on the part of the investors, and there's no pay cap. So if in the worst and unlikely worst-case scenario, the total value of whatever they buy in loans goes to zero, the government will lose 11/12 of the money. In the better-case scenario, where this turns out to be a profitable investment, the government, which will have underwritten 11/12 of the money and put up 1/12 with the private firm, and the FDIC will have let them borrow the other $10, will get half the money, and the private managers will get half the money. But lest you be frightened, all management decisions will be made by the private investor. This is on the loans and on the asset-backed securities portion of it, the other portion. The leverage is going to be kept to a strict minimum of only 100% of capital, so it'll only be 3 parts government on the line to 1 part private on the line. It's a little bit more modest. I would say the more important part of this is probably the loans. And the big issue in the loan market remains a big issue, which is will banks be willing to sell at prices low enough to attract investors? And if they do sell at prices that low, will they need more money? Because what they'll have to bring onto their balance sheets and recognize might render them more insolvent than they otherwise would be.
All right. And just to boil this down by that old maxim of journalism, simplify and exaggerate. The government is bearing most of the risk, and the private investors will claim most of the profits, if any.
They'll get half, but they're going to get access to really cheap capital through the FDIC-insured bonds that give them their leverage, and they're only going to put up half the money, and it's only going to be a small number of firms. The initial estimate from the Treasury is 5, but that's been expanded to maybe somewhere around 10. So the biggest, most important firms are going to get into business with the government, getting 50-50 on the profit share and putting up somewhere between $1 and $12 of actual buying power and $1 and $4 of buying power, whether they're buying loans or asset-backed securities. So they like it as much as you'd probably like it if somebody that you're in business with offered to put up either 11/12 of the money or 3/4 and split the profits with you. You know, this might be the kind of person you wanted to meet again for lunch to talk business.
Yes. But, there is a theory behind this, and I was at the Council on Foreign Relations on Wednesday and heard Geithner himself explaining it. The theory being that the core problem perhaps not the only problem, but a very foundational problem of our current credit difficulties, is that banks have on their balance sheets a lot of assets that that are not priced. No one really knows what they're worth, and the thinking is that people think they're worth less than they really are. By unleashing these private investors to buy this stuff, they're going to find out that the stuff is actually undervalued and has many hidden charms that the markets are not recognizing right now. This will unclog the credit system, and everything will start flowing again, as if Drano has been applied to it. What do you think of that theory?
Well, it's certainly quite possible. It is clear that we had sort of a crazy anticipation of disaster on the part of a lot of market participants, and you have a lot of loans as well as asset-backed securities sitting on bank books that enjoy a valuation of, 25 to 45 cents on the dollar, when the default rates and the delinquency rates on the underlying mortgages are massively lower than that. So are they probably worth more than the banks can get for them? Yes. Are they probably exaggerating the losses that these things are going to take? Yes, but there's a reason they're doing that, which most of the time these free market people like, which is the market's job isn't to tell you what happened 3 weeks ago or what happened 2 days ago or even what happened today. It's to tell you what's going to happen over the next 6 months. And to the extent that we continue to have rising unemployment and to the extent that people continue to see that they owe much more than their house is worth, we continue to be in a situation where people may continue to be delinquent and in default on their houses. And so going forward, it isn't clear that the trajectory of these asset values isn't lower and lower, even if we all admit we don't know where it's going to. That's the mortgages. On the credit cards, we have a big problem because people are starting to default their credit cards and there's no collateral there. And on home equity lines of credit, there's a lot of trouble. And additionally, auto loans are a problem because there's not much to repossess and used car prices are tanking. And repossessing an 11-year-old car is not just physically dangerous, it's pretty much worthless. So you do have some risk in this place that these assets will continue to deteriorate. And probably the bigger problem is that nobody knows what price they're worth. And all we know for sure, what Tim Geithner is going to do, is he's going to put a lot more money out there to chase those assets. And we do know that when more buying power chases anything to buy, whether that's a hot dog after a rock concert or these assets, it'll bid the price up.
And I alluded to this earlier. I said on the announcement of this plan, the stock market went crazy and had a great time. But the credit markets, the bond markets, were much less excited by it. The credit markets in general are still pricing in a whole lot of defaults ahead of us, a whole lot of troubles ahead of us. Now, as I recall back, for example, during the dot-com era, when the stock market was going crazy celebrating our cyber future, the credit markets were much more skeptical and the credit markets turned out to be right. What do you think of that? Those contradictory messages coming from those two markets?
Well, a lot of the credit analysts have a bad habit that it's hard to accuse a lot of the stock pushers of having, which is they have this predilection for sitting there and reading the plan and then having a meeting and discussing what they think the strengths and the weaknesses of the plan are. And a lot of the equity guys tend to respond really quickly to the headlines. So sometimes that knee-jerk blink response is in fact wisdom, and sometimes it's a knee-jerk blink response that you later regret. The credit analysts are sitting there mulling over a lot of problems, and the ones that the folks that I've had the pleasure or misfortune to speak to on the subject lately are very focused on this fact that no matter how much money you throw at an asset, if we fundamentally don't know the price, we still fundamentally don't know the price. And it isn't clear that banks are going to want to sell it cheap enough to excite investors. And there's a risk of a misadventure, because part of what's happening now is all of a sudden having really used the Fed's ballooning balance sheet, which is going to have gone from $800 billion to $3 trillion in about 14 months, what we're discovering is that we can also use the FDIC's balance sheet to take risks. However, what I don't think people have talked about much is throwing extra risk on the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's balance sheet is either going to rescue an area that they don't cover or going to make it harder for them to cover the areas that they do historically cover. And that would be a sort of plain vanilla banking structures and consumer deposits, because we are moving risk onto the FDIC balance sheet and having them insure these public-private investment partnership things that are being pitched out of the Treasury Department right now.
And I noticed that Moody's, the credit rating agency, the other day downgraded the securities, but also the general bank worthiness of Bank of America and Wells Fargo. They downgraded the bank operations, I think, from a B to a D and without the government guarantee. It would be rather alarming. So this is not an abstract issue. You're talking about the FDIC's ability to cover all these bank deposits.
Absolutely. I mean, when we saw the FDIC initially move from going to a relatively lower position of guarantee to a higher, they went from 100,000 to 250,000. We saw an enormous market rally on the thought that, okay, people feel more safe. Just like when we saw the government come in and guarantee money market funds after the buck was broke on Lehman Brothers, all of a sudden people were willing to go back to the money markets. So the FDIC is being used, as it should be, to assure people and make them feel more comfortable in all kinds of monetary deposits. However, even though I do think there's a chance this plan will work, if it doesn't work, and if it doesn't work in a dramatic, violent manner, you have now used the balance sheet of the FDIC. And so the FDIC, along with the Fed and the Treasury, would be implicated in all this. And it means using more TARP money, because they're going to use somewhere between $50 and $100 billion of more TARP money to get this thing going. That'll be the government's matching capital in these funds. And I think watching them use the FDIC and the Fed so heavily in the Treasury is an indication that they are afraid to go back to a public, which is in sort of witch hunt, pitchfork, and torch mode, and ask for any more money for the financial system. And so they're working without going back to get more public money. And the joke is that means taking a greater risk than you might have otherwise if you had more capital and less leverage, and also potentially putting a little more skin in the game here of the FDIC, which so far has been the great savior because it didn't have skin in the game and it was clean from all these operations. And that will not be true going forward given the PPIP proposals that we see from Geithner.
It was interesting at the Council on Foreign Relations event, Geithner was asked how much money is left in the TARP account. And he said substantial amounts, but he wouldn't come up with an actual number. So I guess we don't really know what's left. How much have they spent it all?
I don't think they've spent it all, but they spent a good portion of it. I think the guesstimates are that if you start out with an estimator of around $750 billion that they could play with, they're down to somewhere on the order of $275 billion. And if they just announced a $100 billion plan, then there isn't a whole lot of powder left dry in there. And with the public calling for people's heads and going and protesting in front of their houses who got bailouts, I don't think anyone wants the political job of telling the public, oh, we need a little more money for the banking system. I think that is...
That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's considered political suicide, if not personal suicide, given some of the death threats going around the last couple of weeks.
Well, somebody attacked the house of a British banker, right, who was involved in a bonus scandal over there. So things are getting ugly at a very personal level. Who can blame them, actually? But we've only got 2 minutes left in this segment, so let me just ask you this. If you were in Tim Geithner's shoes, not an enviable position to be in,
my feet would be very sore. I'm a bit taller.
What would you do? I mean, what's the right way to go about doing this?
I think you need to attack more a public good spending initiative, which has been my sort of position on this for a while. I do think we need to rescue the banks. I do think there's a witch hunt sort of analysis going on out there. I don't think we need to rescue them to make the mistakes they made 5 years ago, but we need banking and financial intermediation. And this notion that Wall Street did it and Main Street's innocent is ridiculous. Main Street is absolutely part of every bad decision that was made. And the public needs to learn that it isn't a few bad apples, that it isn't a witch hunt. It's a system that creates these problems. And we can shock that system back into health, but it's a systemic problem. It means it returns. So I do think that's pretty important. And nothing about what Geithner's done has in any way done anything but try to resuscitate a system that I think created these problems. So I think it's at best going to be a fix that lasts, if you're lucky, 36 months at the outside maximum. And it's not going to change any of the structural problems. I think we need to do a large investment in public goods. And I think part of the reason we need to do that is so that the cities don't burn this summer or next. And I think that means we need national health insurance. We need a better retraining program. We need a serious program to keep people in school and in college. And we need to reinvest in our parks and our public schools and give people something that doesn't vary with the economic business cycle so much and a reason for them to join the team and fight for a better future for America writ large.
All right, we have to end it there. But those are just the sorts of things that conservative Democrats in the Senate seem to be trying to block and joining the Republicans on. So that's not good news.
Always great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Max Frodwolf, who is an economist and journalist and contributed to the Huffington Post, among other things. Let's take a break.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And don't forget to visit that. And if you do, press the donate button and keep that cash flow going to us. We need it as much as the Bank of America does, at least. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear another perspective on TARP and PIP and all the current crises. And that's some more from John Adams' Nixon in China, that a piano version of Pat's aria performed by my former neighbor on the Upper West Side, Bruce Brubaker, who has three CDs of excellent minimalist piano music by John Adams and Philip Glass and a couple of others. Very worth checking out. Okay, and now this is an interview recorded earlier in the week with Nomi Prins, who is a former investment banker, now a journalist and frequent writer for Mother Jones and other things. And I thought it, she used to work with these folks and now and knows the world of Wall Street very, very well. And now she's survived to tell these tales. Nomi Prins.
So, Geithner has unleashed his long-awaited plan. What's your capsule review?
Well, I can't see anything in it that's good for anyone who's not a private equity investor or a client of Goldman or Morgan who are effectively waiting to get loans in order to buy some of the assets that they never would have bought in any other way from the government, who has already spent trillions of dollars trying to keep the banks up while they've been having these assets on their books. So there's no really good way of looking at his plan to use more government money to fund the hedge fund community and the private equity community.
Do you see any logic behind this? Is there any kind of economic strategy that makes any sense out of this?
Well, it makes sense to them. I think it makes sense if you're Steven Schwarzman at BlackRock, because you're like, all right, well, I can get money much more cheaply than I could borrow it from anyone else, and my banks aren't lending me money anyway, so I'll get it from the Fed. And go to town. There's no economic strategy for the public, because the assets that are there, they're either never going to have value, might have some value, or might have a lot of value, and that's probably a very small segment of them. BlackRock and Co. are going to get the ones that they want. They're not going to get the ones that we don't want. They're going to have their risk totally kept by the government. The government's going to take the risk, and they're going to take any profit. So for them, it's a great plan, and for the rest of the public who's putting up the money to fund them, we're really just funding a hedge fund that we get no returns from.
Now, I think Geithner's line would be that one of the problems, maybe the fundamental problem with the financial system right now, is that there are a whole bunch of assets that are just hanging around unpriced. Nobody understands them. And this is crippling the financial system. So if we can get, using public publicly subsidized credits, if we can get some hedge fund guys to buy up this stuff, we'll begin the process of pricing. This will unfreeze the markets, and many good things will flow from that eventually. What do you make of that analysis?
Again, go to BlackRock. Steve Schwarzman makes $750 million in his pocket between 2006 and 2007 while these assets were being created, spawned off into the rest of the world, and the equity behind them was put up by a lot of private funds throughout Wall Street to begin with. So their very existence was predicated on money that some of these funds put in, they took out their profits before things started getting bad. Significant profits, profits that are taxed far less than incomes for teachers or firemen or policemen or writers, and walked out of the market. So now that they're being asked to help out, they're being asked to help. It's like, we don't tax you like everyone else. We know you made a ton of money when this stuff was being created. And now, if you don't mind helping us out, we're going to give you some more money in order to extract whatever value you didn't get the first time around. And then we're going to thank you for it. I bet you they're going to even get a tax write-off for it. And it's in some capacity, I'm sure they will figure that out. So we're still in this odd myth that, well, two myths. One, that these assets cannot possibly be priced unless these geniuses come in and price them, and their price is going to be the right price somehow, which I cannot understand the logic of believing, number one. And number two, that somehow once these assets are taken out of the bank's books, that will release all this credit, which will then flow through the country and provide more mortgages and car loans and small business loans and all these things that we're talking about is needed to flow any economy. And yet, they continue to say they don't understand the assets. So the very premise of doing any plan where you don't understand the thing that you're doing the plan for makes absolutely no sense.
But let's talk about this talent argument. You know, there's all this whining about compensation limits that Congress is flirting with and may actually put on the shelf, but you know, they are flirting with it. The complaint is, of course, that this was going to result in an exodus of talent from American banking institutions. You've worked with these people. Describe their talents for us.
You know, I truly believe that anyone who was working at a GM plant could get enough training in a very short period of time to trade credit derivatives, and I would be hard-pressed to think that it could work the other way. Maybe these guys can build cars, I don't know. But the talent to trading is really the talent to having more information than somebody else and understanding the concept of buying and selling. The contracts themselves are not that complicated. They're embedded in tons of documentation, and they probably don't have all the disclosures about all their bells and whistles out there, because I would imagine AIG wasn't really good at keeping them, which was part of the reason, for example, Goldman Sachs, when it thought a few years ago about buying AIG, took a look at their books and, like, we don't really understand what they're doing, so thank you very much. No, yet the government is bailing them. But the guys who created this stuff, the guys who trade this stuff, are not geniuses. They're just people. They don't have any special talents beyond the ability to time things right with the right amount of information, which anyone could do if they had the right amount of information, and exploit it. I suppose that's a talent, but it's not a talent that's worth that much money if it was made more transparent and more regulated and more standardized, the things that they were trading.
Yeah, it seems like the talents involved are some combination of gossip columnist, publicist, and a poker player. This is not stuff that requires advanced degrees, is it?
Absolutely not. And most of the traders in particular don't have the advanced degrees. The modelers might. The people who sort of create the numbers that the traders trade from. But most traders, yeah, I mean, you could be coming from a number of different backgrounds. And, you know, some might be smart, some might not be. Like, just like any other area, any sidewalk in any city has, you know, your series of people that are smart and others with different talents. But they're certainly not worth what they think they're worth and what they've been getting paid.
I was once told that the worst bond trader gets $1 million a year. So if that's the worst in the field, there's something a little odd about that.
Well, that's the whole thing. That goes back to this idea. You can talk about compensation caps and talk about all this, the taxation debate that was going through Congress and everything else. But the fundamental thing is that there's money on the table sloshing all around trading. And it's money on the table because of all of the rules that traders have the luxury of not having. And, you know, it'd be like anybody could play poker really well if they knew all the cards in advance. They'd be just a better poker player because of that, but not because of any inherent talent.
All right, let's leave behind the smelly stuff that exists and talk about how a decent strategy for getting out of this mess would look like. Just lay out some principles for us of what, if you were, say, to replace Neil Cash and Carry, as they say, if you were to replace him, what kind of scheme would you like to see?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't want the assets. I wouldn't want to put capital into the top level or the bank holding company level of any of these institutions, because I would know that it's not going to lending, and I would know I was lying if I said that it was. So number one, if I want to have things lend, what I would do is work on the loan level of any of these institutions. If they have a lot of loans defaulting, I would much rather work with the borrowers and the homeowners and the mortgages and make those loans whole. What that has the effect of doing is making these toxic assets less toxic and therefore requires less money or reserves of banks to put up against them, and we won't have this, you know, plumber clogging situation that Geithner and everybody keeps talking about. I would also split, and I've been saying this for years, and trillions of dollars of money has gone out the window to do the opposite, is that you have to split up the players in the financial arena. You have to split them between commercial-oriented depositor lenders and speculated entities of banks. You have to make sure that if you're a hedge fund or if you're an AIG being a hedge fund, or if you're part of an AIG being a hedge fund, if you're part of a Bank of America being a hedge fund, you don't get government backing. You just don't. And if you screw up, you get dissected from the bigger mothership, and the government comes in and it continues to back deposits and it continues to back loans to the extent that that helps the U.S. economy and homeowners. And that's it. You don't throw money at the big institution when that money only gets sucked into the most risky practices and the most complicated assets and the least transparent parts of the company. You specifically stay away from those, and you say, if I don't understand it, if I can't get the loss, if I can't understand why giving that money will actually help the economy and help the people who deal with this bank or this insurance company and their policies, I'm just not going to spend it. And that would be the policy that I would do, and I think it would save money for the country, because any of us know that if we spend money on things that look like they don't have value, when we can't even evaluate them, but we sense that that's the case, it doesn't make sense to go there. Yet that is what the consistent plan has been in Washington.
And finally, it looks to me like the Obama administration is totally in awe of Wall Street. They really do seem to think that they're the best and the brightest, and they're looking to them to save us. What do you make of this?
It's annoying. You know, Obama this Friday is going to meet with the same set of leaders from Goldman and J.P. Morgan and the like that went up to Washington in October to ask for a way to get them out of their credit situations and their asset problems. And he's not sitting down with people from the outside who don't have the vested interest in just getting the money to them as opposed to fixing the greater problems that they've caused to the general economy. And I don't understand that. I don't get how you look at the tally and you look at the trillions of dollars between federal loan facilities from the Federal Reserve and Treasury bailouts and more money to the FDIC to back the banks that are failing and everything else, and you add that all up and it's $10 to $12 trillion, and you keep sitting down with these people. It makes no sense. If it was any of their own money, their own, i.e. not the public, their own from their pocket, their own, you know what, Geithner, you put down $6 and Steve Schwarzman from BlackRock will put down $1 and let's see how that plays out. I think it would be very different, but you're right. There's. I don't know if it's awe. I don't know if it's this sort of intellectual complacency. I'm not sure what it is. Any of them should sit down and just sort of, I don't know, learn what a derivative is, learn what a CDO is, learn what an asset is, learn what a bank does. And that might demystify some of the talent and awe that the players are somehow showing that they have by virtue of them holding all the information.
And that was Noemi Prinz, the investment banker turned journalist. And a minor correction, Steve Schwarzman is with Blackstone. BlackRock is Larry Fink. Not that that really matters all that much, but we do like to run corrections if necessary. And Noemi is a journalist, former investment banker, and author of several books, Jacked, Other People's Money, and frequent contributor to Newsday and to Mother Jones now. All right. Shifting from labor to from capital to labor. There has been, over the last couple of years, a big fight in the labor movement between the Service Employees International Union and the California Nurses Association, the roles that the two played in caricature. This is my position, but not everyone would agree with this, but this is my position. SEIU played this kind of corporate-friendly role, making deals with corporations, palled around with CEOs, made a lot of compromises on healthcare policy. Wrote big checks to the Democrats. CNA, a much more politically radical union, supported the Labor Party, pushed for a single-payer program nationally, and denounced SEIU and its president, Andy Stearns, as corporate tools. Suddenly, surprising almost everyone, they put all that behind them with a March 18th announcement of a peace deal. Meanwhile, a large West Coast local within SEIU has split off to form a new union, the National Union of Healthcare Workers. Its leadership had been very critical of Stern and the SEIU leadership for reasons very similar to CNA. Stern moved to take it over, and facing that takeover, much of the membership voted to secede. Meanwhile, number two, two unions that merged several years ago, Unite, a clothing and textile workers union, and HERE, a hotel and restaurant workers union, are on the verge of a nasty split. In SEIU's Stern is getting deeply involved in the fight, taking Unite's side. And meanwhile, number three, labor's top political priority, the Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA, which would make it a lot easier to organize unions, is in deep political trouble now in Washington. And so in search of what it all means, we asked the labor journalist Steve Early to clarify it all in 15 minutes. So, Steve Early.
So, Steve, what do you make of this peace agreement? It's, you know, it's like the Hatfields and McCoys, isn't it?
Well, I think the analogy that I hear cited most often in the labor movement involves a certain controversial pre-World War II alliance that was struck between Germany and the Soviet Union, which also divided up some turf between them in a way that seemed opportune to the parties at the time, but neither side really liked or trusted each other. The deal was inherently unstable, and it didn't last long, and soon one party to it was invading the other. I think this is similar to the extent that, you know, we've had two rival labor organizations feuding with each other for a number of years. The CNA, California Nurses, claiming on its side that there were major ideological differences involved in this conflict, and now suddenly doing a rather sudden political about-face, negotiating a truce, which does make gains for the CNA, but leaves other people who are continuing to challenge the leadership of SEIU in a somewhat weaker position.
Yeah, I want to talk about that just a minute and then talk about the larger labor movement. Part of what they were fighting about was healthcare reform and single payer. CNA was very enthusiastically for it. Andy Stern of SEIU was talked scornfully of Canadian imports. We need to do it in the American way. He was buddying up with the chair of Walmart and making a lot of questionable alliances. Can they just sweep all that under the rug?
Well, I think the press releases that have been issued by both SEIU and CNA about their peace pact do attempt to sidestep those past differences as well. As what SEIU is saying now is that they will join with CNA to lobby for a single-payer solution to the national health care crisis. A lot of unions do that. They endorse single-payer legislation, but then position themselves in what they believe is a more pragmatic and realistic fashion on behalf of greatly inferior reform proposals, which they actually put much more time and money into lobbying for. So I would just see them continuing to do that, whereas the CNA, to its credit, has been really consistent in its support for Canadian-style national health insurance, and I think will continue to be a very active part of the single-payer coalition, which is trying to get a seat at the table with the administration in the development of labor law health care reform legislation.
But that also symbolized what, to at least an outside observer, looked like a very a stark political difference on the whole approach to union, the union movement. That Stern looked like he was, as a friend of mine put it, saw the labor movement as one big human resource department. It was all about cutting deals with CEOs and being partners in business, where the CNA took a real social movement approach to unionism, or so it seemed, that they were representing the whole interests of the whole working class and not eager to cut deals with corporate America. They're going to sweep that under the rug, too?
Oh, I think that's what's so short-sighted about this on their behalf. They certainly have won a narrow organizational victory to the extent that the service employers have been forced to kind of recognize the primacy and the leadership of the CNA in California and other parts of the country around issues of concern to RNs. But in terms of the broader situation in the healthcare industry, there's a major rebellion within Stern's own ranks. Since he put his third largest local United Healthcare Workers West in trusteeship in January, the elected leaders of that group have formed a new independent union in California, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, and it's mounting a major challenge to SEIU. And you would think that this chip off the old purple block, the NUHW, which has been moving in the direction of CNA politically over the last year or two, would be a more natural ally at this point for CNA, rather than the international union, which it has so roundly denounced for years.
So why didn't they do that? Now, if I can see from Stern's point of view, he may not want to fight a two-front war, but why wasn't CNA eager to embrace a new potential ally?
Well, it did initially and has been providing financial assistance to the National Union of Healthcare Workers as it attempts to win bargaining rights away from the trusteeship of the old UHW. And while that support was welcome, I think it also served as a kind of bargaining chip, brought Stern to the table, gave the CNA leverage, and as part of this deal, the nurses have agreed not to continue to provide financial support to the insurgent NUHW in California. Its members on the ground who work in the same hospital systems may continue to support those trying to replace SEIU as their bargaining representative, but this represents a real victory for SEIU in terms of shutting down one important source of financial support for the new union.
One of the attacks that SEIU used to mount against CNA was that they were kind of a snotty professional union who only wanted to deal with nurses, whereas SEIU dealt with orderlies and the people who cleaned bedpans. What is this peace agreement? Does this shed any light on that that relationship?
Well, it what it projects, you know, if it holds up, and again, I'm skeptical because I don't think the parties trust each other. I don't think they like each other, and they have a 15-year history of not getting along. But it projects a division of labor in new organizing in states where hospital workers generally are not well organized and nurses either, where the CNA and its allies would focus on organizing units, bargaining units of professional nurses in hospitals, and there would be complementary campaigns conducted by the service employees for the LPNs and the aides and the other hospital workers that they represent. And as opposed to the past, where there's been a conflict between the CNA's so-called craft union approach and SEIU's attempt to organize hospitals on a wall-to-wall basis.
One of the points of disagreement between the two unions has historically been over the agreements that, most people accused SEIU of making a lot of agreements with employers that rendered a whole lot of issues off the bargaining table. Workers would not engage in whistleblowing behavior. The union would often lobby on behalf of corporate medical interests in state legislatures. They would agree not to organize certain units and the ones that the employers designated. There are a whole series of these agreements. A lot of people outside SEIU found kind of smelly. SEIU people said that CNA did the same. What's your analysis of that particular conflict?
The criticisms you just made were, until recently, made very strongly by the CNA of SEIU. And the CNA, I think, does have generally a much better track record of positioning itself as a strong voice not only for nurses but for quality patient care. And they have opposed organizing rights deals which compromise the ability of a union to be a whistleblower and complain about unsafe conditions in hospitals or nursing homes. And this has also become a major point of difference with the West Coast dissidents within SEIU have now broken away to try to form a union of their own. The partnership that's just been created projects joint organizing within major healthcare chains like Tenet and the Catholic healthcare systems around the country, where the two unions would somehow have to reconcile those differences if they were to succeed in winning mechanisms for union recognition in non-union hospitals and other parts of the country that both would benefit from. So I think there is a danger that CNA may be watering down in the future its previously fairly strong position in this area. The CNA folks would say, we did not agree to agree about everything. We'll continue to have political and organizational differences with SEIU, but this one goes to the heart of the joint organizing and bargaining that they're proposing to do and the strategy that they're likely to pursue.
Stern's philosophy has been all about density. That is, that the he wanted to have his union grow as much as possible, the labor movement grow as much as possible. Once you achieved a certain level of density, wonderful and magical things would happen. If you look at some of the agreements, maybe the workers didn't do so well under that that growth strategy. What do you think of that critique?
SEIU is clearly one of the fastest growing unions in the country, but within its core jurisdiction, private hospitals, less than 10% of the workforce is organized. Among nursing, where there's many different unions representing nurses, less than 20% of the 2.5 million nurses in the country are union members. So there's clearly a lot of room for increased density. I think what critics of Stern, which have included in the past the leaders of CNA and certainly include the leaders of the new California Healthcare Union, are saying is that you cannot trade off existing wages and hours and benefits and good contracts in return for organizing deals. Because if you have an existing membership base that's unhappy, that's disgruntled, that feels that its issues and problems are not being properly addressed, you're not going to really succeed in the long run in organizing millions of unorganized workers unless you're planning to do it with the help of employers. And that really raises the question of what kind of contracts these newly organized members are going to have and whether they're really going to have substantially strengthened rights on the job from when they were non-union.
While this is all happening, another union is on the verge of falling apart. Unite Here, a product of a merger that does not look too stable right now, and Andy Stern is a player in that. Tell us what's going on there and what you think of it.
Well, I think if you want to ask someone about how trustworthy President Stern is as a negotiating partner, you might want to check in with the head of the hotel workers, John Wilhelm, at this point. I mean, just 4 years ago, Wilhelm was one of Stern's best buddies, a fellow founding father of the new Change to Win coalition when they joined forces to leave the AFL-CIO and create something that was supposed to be new and better and more successful at organizing. Today, Wilhelm and his merger partner, Bruce Rayner, from the garment workers, are in the middle of an incredibly embarrassing and messy divorce, and Stern has put himself right in the middle of it and is now attempting to affiliate that portion of the Unite Here membership that was merged 4 years ago, and has announced that the SEIU is now going to get involved in organizing workers in casinos and hotels and restaurants, which has traditionally been the jurisdiction of the hotel workers. So one of the unions involved in Change to Win, the hotel workers, is now leaving that new coalition, applying for readmission to the AFL. And John Wilhelm has joined the chorus of critics of Andy Stern.
Well, this is all rather unseemly at a moment when the economy is in crisis and there's a new administration which is at least somewhat more labor-friendly than its predecessor. What do you think of this all means for the labor movement?
Well, a number of people pointed out that it's very bad timing to be having these kinds of messy, embarrassing internecine disputes. I mean, when you have any kind of cynical, self-serving maneuvering at the top of the labor movement, however it's dressed up in triumphant press releases, and it has little to do with the problems of rank-and-file members at the base and workplaces, I think it deepens cynicism about the labor leadership inside and outside the movement. The Employee Free Choice Act, this attempt in Washington to get long overdue labor law reform, is in deep trouble inside the Beltway because of wavering Democratic Party support for it. At the same time, and I think further undermining labor's campaign for new organizing and bargaining rights, is this a series of disputes we've just discussed where thousands of people in California who are members of SEIU have petitioned for elections to leave SEIU, and Stern and his union are trying to block them from having any free choice to do that. And in the situation of the hotel workers and the garment workers, again, you have a split. Some people want to leave. Some people want to stay. And the way the whole thing has been handled by the leadership makes it look very hypocritical and inconsistent in terms of how it's actually dealing with employee free choice among unionized workers.
Well, and finally, this is not what we would have hoped in the midst of an economic crisis and people talking about a New Deal too. This is not what we expected. What do you see as the political prospects for the labor movement in the coming years?
Well, I think just as in the 30s, and maybe this is romantic, magical thinking on my part, but we'll see, the deepening economic crisis is going to lead at some point to more insurgency from below, more rank-and-file activity directed at union structures that are not responding effectively at the moment. And I think we've already seen evidence of that in California with the creation of this new healthcare workers union, which I think is very promising, the NUHW. And it reflects not just a few top leaders deciding to take their marbles and leave, but thousands of workers meeting together in mass meetings, debating and discussing the future of their union, and making decisions in a democratic and rank and file way that hasn't been seen in many years. And I think, as difficult as the path is that the NUHW is pursuing in trying to leave SEIU and build a new union, I think it may provide a model for workers in other unions who are similarly dissatisfied with the lack of democracy, lack of responsiveness, and the ineffectiveness of a lot of labor's legislative and political action and bargaining and organizing activity.
And that's the voice of the labor journalist Steve Early, talking about splits in the House of Labor, but concluding on an optimistic note. Which is always a good thing to conclude on. All right, that's it from me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week, and let's go out, instead of the usual rollicking, noisy electro or whatever, let's go out with this bit from Robert Schumann's Fantasy in C Major, performed by Alfred Brendel. Till next week. Bye.